Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. It may be a wetter than average year, but in a state like New Mexico, wildfire is always a concern. As of today, several fires are burning in our state, including 5,000 acres in the Cibola National Forest. This morning, we are going to be chatting with members of the U.S. Forest Service and National Park Service about the logistics of fighting and prescribing fires, the importance of climate prediction models in dealing with fires, and what sort of ecological impact wildfires or a lack of wildfires have on our forests. And we want to hear from you. How do you prepare for fire season? What steps do you take when camping to make sure your pit fires don't get out of control? Have you or someone you know been affected by a wildfire? Give us a call at 505-277-5866. Tweet to us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM or send us an email at letstalk@kunm.org. Now, I am joined today by several employees of the U.S. Forest Service as well as the National Park Service, all of whom deal with the reality of wildfires on a daily basis. Mark Thibodeau, Fire Information Officer. Morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
And Carl Malcolm, Regional Wildfire Ecologist. How are you?
Hey, doing well. Regional wildlife ecologist,
actually, because
we also have some wildfire expertise us today.
They are both with me in the studio, and joining us by phone will be...
In a bit.
We'll have Tessa Nicolay, regional fire ecologist, and Rich Naden, fire meteorologist with Predictive Services and the National Park Services. So, good morning, guys, and... First of all, as we can tell from the number of you guys that are joining us today, dealing with fires must be a huge part of the work that the Forest Service does. How many Forest Service folks deal with various aspects of fires in New Mexico?
So fighting wildfires and, you know, looking at predictive services and the fuel conditions that we have on the grounds is just one part of the U.S. Forest Service and our cooperating agencies and stakeholders. But, you know, we have a lot of different aspects, including wildlife and hydrology and archaeology as well. So, you know, that's just one aspect of the job, but it does impact and provide a lot of overlap into other departments, especially with wildlife, which we're thankful to have a specialist here with us.
When it comes to like wildfires in New Mexico, are there like unique aspects to how that works in this state?
The unique aspects of fighting wildfire is it's a constantly dynamic and changing situation depending on the location and the fuel conditions, topography, weather. So any wildfire in any part of the country is really can be challenging to fight. And keeping in mind the public and firefighter safety is our number one priority. So we really, New Mexico is a little unique in that it has a certain type of fuel conditions and a certain type of environment, especially with those erratic winds that we get with the thunderstorms this time of the year. But it's always challenging across the entire country.
So even in a time when there are a lot of like rainstorms, so the winds can actually make it more difficult to fight fires, or how does that impact wildfires in New Mexico?
Yeah, that's the most challenging portion of fighting a wildfire is predicting that weather. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've asked Predictive Services to join us today. Right. And, you know, it's the most variable component of fighting fire. So we can often predict and look at how that's going to affect the wildfires, but we, you know, the wind is what the wind is and it'll do what it does.
And, you know, it's not just about fighting or preventing the fires. What other aspects of wildfires are part of the work that you guys do at the service?
So other aspects of fire?
Yeah, exactly. How is fire important for what you guys do at the U.S. Forest Service?
Well, you know, fuels mitigation is another important component. Mm-hmm. When we look at fighting wildfires and or preparing for those wildfires. So in the fuels and aviation mm-hmm. is another big component. The fire department, I guess you could say, is responsible for aviation services within the U.S. Forest Service as well. So that fuels mitigation and aviation are the other two really big components.
Okay. Go ahead, Carl. You have something to add?
Yeah, just chime in here a little bit. You know, when I think about the work that the agency does and what our responsibilities are in terms of public service, at the heart of it is, you know, the notion that we really need to take care of the public lands that we steward on behalf of the American people. And fundamental to achieving that mission is being able to manage for the ecological integrity of these landscapes. And when we think about the forests of New Mexico and the grasslands of New Mexico, it's certainly the case that fire has been a huge part of these ecosystems for millennia. And in large part due to human efforts to suppress wildfires over the course of the last 100 years, a lot of our forests are suffering as a result of that fire suppression and the absence of fire from the landscape. And so when it comes to how we talk about and think about fire, you know, fire can be obviously a very negative thing if we're talking about uncharacteristically severe wildfires, if we're talking about very negative effects to communities, if we're talking about the loss of homes or even the loss of lives, as we've seen with some of our large and severe fires elsewhere in the West in recent years. We know it can be a negative thing, but it's also important to remember that these ecosystems have evolved in the presence of fire. And when we're able to play a part in getting more of that beneficial fire on the landscape, we're doing a good thing for the land and doing a good thing for the water and the wildlife, et cetera. So it's really fundamental to us achieving our land stewardship mission to be able to play a role in getting good fire on the landscape.
Okay, we are definitely going to be talking more about those aspects as well in a bit. I do just want to let the folks listening at home know, unfortunately, we are not going to be taking calls today. However, you can email us, letstalk@kunm.org, and tweet to us, #letstalknm. So how is fire season in New Mexico looking this year, Mark?
Well, it has been a little bit wetter this year, which has provided an excellent opportunity for us to look at managing fires or, you know, using different strategies and tactics to fight fire to benefit the ecological side of the U.S. Forest Service. So,
what sort of strategies are better used in a wetter year like this one?
Well, you know, depending on the burning conditions, we might let those fires creep around and, you know, move as they do to create that better wildlife habitat and have less of an impact in the event of a super dry year where those same fires may cause devastating impacts to that environment. So, you know, that's just one aspect. And it's also provided us the opportunity to do more prescribed fire. Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure we'll get into later, that prescribed fire has a unique set of parameters that we look at before we put that drip torch to the ground and create those better ecological impacts for our environment. So reducing the fuel loading and, you know, providing a better habitat for our wildlife.
Now, are we seeing fewer fires this year, or are they just smaller?
You know, at this time, the human versus lightning fires is almost 50-50. So we're not seeing a lesser amount of fires, but yeah, firefighters are able to pick those up a little bit faster due to that smaller size, and you know, especially from the public just helping out and reporting those fires as early as possible. We really do appreciate that. Dial that 911 if you see smoke out in the distance.
Absolutely. So now, Carl Malcolm. You are currently a wildlife ecologist, but your work still finds you dealing with fire as a vital part of what you do. Can you tell me a bit about the relationship between wildfires and wildlife?
You bet. So when we think about the multiple use mandate that the Forest Service operates under, one of the things that we need to be considerate of is trying to manage these national forests to benefit a host of species, and that could be threatened and endangered species, and also species that the public is interested in for hunting purposes. Basically, the whole cast of biodiversity that exists on these landscapes falls under our purview. And so when we think about the ecology of these southwestern ecosystems, we know not only the vegetation, but also the wildlife have evolved in the presence of high severity fire and mixed severity fire and low severity fire at different spatial extents. And this is, you know, there's a lot of diversity and complexity associated with the diversity of the ecosystems we manage. So if you think about working your way up a mountain range from desert scrub down, like we could think of the Sandias, for example, mm-hmm. And how that anybody who's driven up the Crest Highway sees that transition in the ecosystems that associate with different elevational bands. And Mark pointed to how fuel plays a really critical role in how we manage a wildfire. It also relates directly to the management objectives of the landscape. So for example, if we're talking about managing ponderosa pine forests, which have historically had very frequent, typically low to moderate severity fire, if we fail to include that fire in our management regimes of those forests, we're doing a disservice to all of the inhabitants mm-hmm. of that ecosystem, including the wildlife. So boiling it down, if we want to do a good job of caring for the wildlife and meeting our responsibilities under that multiple use mandate, we need to do a good job of managing fire. Mm-hmm. And that relationship between wildlife, their habitat, and fire is absolutely central to our work in a place like the Southwest, where fire has been such a huge part of these systems.
So can you tell me a bit about how fire can affect wildlife habitat?
Sure. So, you know, again, I would say it depends on what kind of fire we're talking about. And I would contrast the kinds of fires that we have had historically. Again, thinking about, say, ponderosa pine forests, for example, we know based on dendrochronology, where we look at the rate of fire, basically by looking at tree rings, and we can discern that historically those ponderosa pine forests were burning on the order of every 5 to 20 years or so, up until we had major suppression of wildfires concurrent with the introduction of grazing and concurrent with the introduction of us really trying to jump on every start as soon as it ignited. And so in those systems, if we preclude fire, what we get is a very robust growth of lots of seedlings and saplings, juvenile ponderosa pine, and we end up in that system with these forests that we would call like a dog hair ponderosa pine forest, where, you know, that nomenclature relates to the idea that the forest is so thick with these small trees that it's like looking at the hair on the back of a dog. All right. So in that situation, not only is that landscape going to be particularly prone to a very high severity fire, where that vertical complexity is able to carry fire from the ground up into the crown, and you can end up with these running crown fires that basically have the potential to kill the vast majority of trees in a stand, or even, you know, in some cases over the course of hundreds of thousands of acres. That kind of a fire behavior pattern is going to essentially eliminate wildlife habitat, at least for an order of decades, potentially centuries. And in the face of a changing climate, it's possible that in the wake of a fire like that, you might actually change the type of vegetation that exists there in perpetuity. So you have the potential essentially to eliminate wildlife habitat through a large, uncharacteristically severe wildfire. And I would contrast that to the kinds of fires that we've had historically, which typically burned at a smaller scale, so fewer acres, and then they were much more patchy in terms of the severity. You might have a few places where there's some torching, and by torching I mean large mature trees that are burned up, but for the most part we'd be talking about fires that are burning relatively low temperature across the forest floor, consuming those surface fuels. And what that does is it kills some of the saplings and seedlings, so you avoid that pattern of the dog hair forest, if you will. And it maintains a relatively open canopy. And from a wildlife standpoint, that's very important, because the more open canopy allows more of that sunlight to reach the forest floor. And what that does is it promotes the existence, the persistence of grasses, forbs, and shrubs. And that vegetation really provides the foundation for the whole host of biodiversity that would exist in that system. So if we fail to get fire on that landscape, essentially we're compromising the existence of that vegetation that's so important for the species that live there.
Okay, this is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. What questions do you have about the U.S. Forest Service fire policy? Do you have concerns about prescribed burns or forest thinning procedures? We are not able to take calls at this time, but we are taking tweets at hashtag Let's Talk NM, and you can email us at letstalk@kunm.org. We'll be right back.
Support provided by Organic Books, an independent bookstore in Albuquerque's historic Knob Hill. Family-owned and operated, Organic Books offers used and new titles and spotlights local authors and poets. Book signings and workshops held each weekend. Complete details at organicbooks.net.
Glassrite, New Mexico's own. Since 1984, manufacturing and installing vinyl replacement windows. Built in New Mexico for our unique climate. Plus wood-clad windows by Gelled Wen. On Gibson or at glassrite.com. Glassrite supports KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. We're talking about wildfires in the Southwest. And you can email us comments and questions at letstalk@kunm.org. I'd like to go back to you, Carl. You're the wildlife ecologist with one of the wildlife ecologists with the U.S. Forest Service. And we were talking about how wildfires can impact wildlife both positively and negatively. I'd like to kind of narrow that down to endangered species in the state. Can you tell us a little bit about how some of our state's endangered species are affected?
You bet. And it's going to depend, you know, certainly on which species we're talking about. But when it comes to listed species and we start thinking about fire, the first species that pops to my mind is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and that's the Mexican spotted owl. And there's no species here in the Southwest that the Forest Service spends more time thinking about and surveying at a regional scale than the Mexican spotted owl. And it's interesting to look at the history of our management of that species since it was listed, because listeners might be familiar with some of the controversy around spotted owl management, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, and how that played into some of the decisions around lumber production from those landscapes. And initially, when it came to the management of Mexican spotted owls in the Southwest, the thinking was that the timber industry in these forests was posing one of the greatest threats to Mexican spotted owls, that the removal of large old trees was the thing that we needed to be most worried about when it came to trying to conserve that species. And the initial recovery plan, which is something that the Fish and Wildlife Service produces under the Endangered Species Act to guide management of a given species like the owl, pointed to that harvesting of large old trees as a fundamental problem. But the recognition of fire as a threat to the Mexican spotted owl actually drove the Fish and Wildlife Service to revise their recovery plan in 2012. And that revised recovery plan points to uncharacteristically severe wildfire as the greatest threat to the conservation of that species. And so when it comes to managing Mexican spotted owl habitat, for example, we basically have a couple of choices. We know that these systems are going to burn at some point, and the question is, what kind of fire do we want to have? Do we want to have a fire that is uncharacteristically severe and at a large spatial extent, or do we want to try to restore the heterogeneity or the kind of diversity to the landscape that promotes those patchy and mixed severity burns that a species like the Mexican spotted owl would have evolved with? And it's a tricky management quandary because when we're talking about getting fire back on the landscape, you know, there's potential to have negative impacts, even potentially mortality for some of the wildlife on the landscape. But in my mind, it's not unlike the conversation around smoke. You know, you can have smoke associated with a very large high severity fire, or you can have smoke associated with, for example, prescribed burning or managed fire. And in either case, you know, the public is likely to have some negative experiences as a result of that smoke. But you can choose, do you want to have a whole lot of smoke all at once, or do you want to have a little bit of smoke spaced out over time? And I would apply that same thinking to the conservation of a species like the Mexican spotted owl. Do you want to have, basically kick the can down the road and try to keep fire out of those systems, knowing that at some point it's very likely to burn and there are very likely to be some high severity impacts? Or do we want to try to get more fire back into that system to try to maintain that heterogeneity in the landscape so that the owl might be able to persist and thrive longer.
Okay, and now I'd like to welcome into the conversation Tessa Nicolet, who's joining us by phone. Tessa is a fire ecologist. Hi, Tessa.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Thank you for being on. Now, you deal with wildfires also as a natural part of the environment, and you actually started your career as a wildlife ecologist. How did you become drawn to fire ecology?
You know, I started my career with the Forest Service chasing the Mexican spotted owls at night through the Lincoln National Forest in southern New Mexico. And it was through that work that I realized that the biggest factor, as Carl mentioned just a minute ago, that was influencing the survival in the habitat for the Mexican spotted owl was fire. And so I became pretty fascinated with how fire interacts with our ecosystems. And so I decided to go back to school. And so I went to Flagstaff at NAU there and worked on my master's in fire ecology.
Great. So can you tell us a little bit more about how wildfire fits into the natural life cycle of a forest?
Absolutely. So wildfires, especially in the Southwest, and when I say the Southwest, I'm talking about Arizona and New Mexico in particular. Wildfire was a very frequent visitor to most of our ecosystems historically. And when I say historically, I mean pre-settlement era. So we're talking about pre-1880s. Wildfire would come through these ecosystems, and in a lot of ways, Carl kind of touched upon this already, but would help maintain those systems in a state that was more sustainable from lots of disturbances, including drought that we've seen the past couple years as well. So regulating the amount of reproductions of trees, regulating the amount of debris, so needles, branches, that was accumulating on the forest floor, taking those nutrients from that debris and recycling it back into the soil, which then makes for a more productive understory for those herbs and shrubs that Carl was mentioning earlier that are so important to wildlife.
So can you tell me how...
Yeah, so a huge...
How are human-caused fires different than these natural fires that are, say, started by lightning or other means?
So especially in our day and age now, our human-caused fires, for one thing, tend to be in proximity to human habitat, if you will, or where we have a lot of public interface with our natural ecosystems. So one of the big concerns from a fire management perspective is safety, public safety. We have these fires that are ignited near homes, near values that exist for us as humans.
Could you explain that term, values?
Absolutely, values, yeah. So values could be anything that we value on our landscape. So it could be wildlife habitat that Carl already talked about. It could be our recreation sites, so maybe campgrounds, visitor centers, maybe things like our national parks or any kind of high interest area for our publics. It could be our communication towers. It could be anything that we value as a society, as a public, that is susceptible to fire, that has the potential to be damaged by fire, including our homes, right?
So could you tell me a little bit about prescribed burns and how those impact the ecology of the forest?
Absolutely. So prescribed fires is our attempt as fire managers to reintroduce fire to our ecosystems. What we do with prescribed fire is we first identify an area of ground that could benefit from fire. So either that area had been treated in the past mechanically in the sense that it had maybe been logged or thinned or masticated in some cases, or maybe this area just is ready to see fire. In the sense that the fuels, when I say fuels, I mean vegetation. So the trees or the shrubs or the grasses are in a state that would benefit from fire. And we try to find weather windows. What I mean by weather windows is maybe some temperature ranges or relative humidity ranges and wind parameters that would be conducive to put fire on that landscape in a way that we can control it. So a prescribed fire is our attempt to reintroduce the frequency of low severity fire to our ecosystems in a way that we can still control it.
Okay, now I have an email comment from William, and he says specifically the Sandia Mountains have a lot of dead trees and there's lots of activity because they're so close to Albuquerque. He would like to know what is being done to restore the health of the forest there and avoid catastrophic fires. And Carl?
So I'd chime in here just given that I'm pretty familiar with the area. So I'm a resident of the East Mountains myself, and the Sandias are right there in my backyard, basically. So spent a lot of time poking around, and this listener is absolutely right that the Sandia Mountains are suffering as a result of fire exclusion. And the complexity associated with trying to get fire back on that landscape, there are a couple of big hurdles. The first of which is the fact that you have so many homes that are there in the wildland-urban interface. And the second is that a lot of the Sandia Mountain is a designated wilderness area. So being able to manage or reintroduce prescribed fire into a wilderness comes with its own host of complicating factors. But on the bright side, there is a strip along, and I'm going to focus on the east side of the Sandias. There's a strip of National Forest System land that is not designated wilderness between the private land and the wilderness farther up the mountain. And the Sandia Ranger District of the Cibola National Forest has been very active in trying to implement treatments back there. So anybody who drives up Highway 14, if you look off to the west side of Highway 14, you'll see a number of treatments that have been implemented to try to reduce the fuel load. Those include the Sulfur Project and the Hondo Project, and also a number of projects up the mountain trying to get some of those dead trees basically removed, especially along the Crest Highway. So the Sandia Ranger District has been really active in trying to basically create a buffer between the wilderness and the communities that are downstream, downhill. And, you know, in the future, I think that that wilderness area in particular, thinking about management opportunities to try to get good fire back on the landscape up there is something that our agency colleagues are going to be putting a lot of thought into.
Okay. And Tessa, that's exactly what you were talking about before. And I want to go back to you and just ask, how does the service kind of balance these ecological interests in having having either a prescribed fire or a natural wildfire, and while still making sure that the needs of the human population are taken care of?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think it's a difficult balance at times, Ty. So we have to balance the smoke impacts, for instance, and that's something that Carl mentioned earlier. Is smoke is unhealthy to many people, and so we definitely have to be careful at how much smoke we expose our publics to. We have to be careful with how that landscape changes and how that landscape is then post fire going to respond to our weather events, such as the monsoon and heavy rains, so post-fire flooding. But in general, what we really need to be doing is positioning ourselves with our treatments, be it mechanical treatments or prescribed fire, in a way that allows us to then respond to that natural ignition, so a lightning strike, let's say, that starts a wildfire, in a way that's beneficial for that landscape. And that might mean not putting it out, right? That might mean being able to allow that fire to move across that landscape in its natural role, but have set up prescribed burns or mechanical treatments near or along our public values that then protect those from that fire, but still allow it to move naturally through our ecosystem.
And in fact, we have an email comment from Teresa, and she points out that you can't always introduce fire safely without doing some mechanical treatment first. So could we talk about what is mechanical treatment? And I'd just like to put that to the panel. Mark?
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Tessa.
Go ahead, Mark. So when we say mechanical treatments, we're talking about anything mechanical going into the forest and changing the fuel structure. And when I say fuel structure, I'm again talking about vegetation, so trees, shrubs, in some cases even the grasses. So mechanical could be some sort of logging, depending on what that forest type looks like. We can use logging to better change that fuel structure so that fire can move through there safely. It could be thinning, so that's a type of, it's almost like logging, but it's cutting mostly smaller trees out from underneath the larger canopy of the forest. And it could be mastication, where we go through and kind of crush or shred some of the vegetation and leave it on the forest floor, or take it out for biofuels or some kind of other resource.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us today, Tessa. I am going to be taking a break now. So we're talking about fire season in New Mexico here on Let's Talk New Mexico, 89.9 KUNM. We want to hear from you. What tips do you have for preventing fires? Have you seen other people being careless with their fires while camping? What did they do wrong? You can email us, letstalk@kunm.org, and we'll be back in a moment.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Representing Native American tribes, people facing criminal charges, civil rights plaintiffs, and victims of sexual abuse. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Support comes from Inverse Medical, providing medical devices and post-acute patient direct services from hospital to home across New Mexico and rural communities. Complete information at inversemed.com.
Okay, welcome back to Let's Talk at New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. And now, kind of going with this, these questions about prescribed burns, I'd like to ask Mark and Carl, how do you take steps to make sure that these prescribed burns do not get out of control?
Well, that's a great question, and there's a unique set of parameters. They're called the prescribed fire because they have a prescription, just like you get from a doctor. If we look at the fuels, the weather, and the topography to implement the right burning strategies, different tactics that we can use to implement that fire on those grounds. One of the things that prescribed fire managers and fire managers alike across the state of New Mexico look at is maybe aerial ignitions in areas that are really rugged and really steep. So they use what we call plastic sphere dispensers, or PSDs, and they're little balls. They almost look like ping pong balls, and they have a chemical in them that, when injected with another non-threatening chemical, they cause fires when they hit the ground out of the helicopters.
Okay, so they're dropped from helicopters.
Yeah, so helicopters or unmanned aircraft systems.
Like drones?
Like drones, yeah. So we use these smaller fires to grow together to create that low impact fire on the ecosystem to better diversify the environment for our wildlife and species.
So that's one way to do it, is you make sure that it's a kind of a more remote area. What about when the prescribed burn is near human habitation? What sort of steps are taken at that point?
Yeah, so there's a little more notification and a little more planning that goes into that, especially with those smoke impacts. We do work with the New Mexico Air Quality and really have that tough discussions about where that smoke is going to go and how that might impact the communities downwind. So the wildland-urban interface is a main focus of the U.S. Forest Service, and we do need to think about the mechanical treatments versus the prescribed fire and the communities that are affected, and how we might be able to better mitigate large wildfires when it comes to a community near you, and for future reference.
So in a worst case scenario where a prescribed burn has gotten out of control, what happens then?
Well, so there's a 24-hour waiting period. There's some policy that was put in place from previous fires that have escaped control. And, you know, the impacts that are associated with those fires that do get out of control, or, you know, something that the Forest Service and our other partners and cooperators take very seriously. And we do everything in our and our abilities to try to prevent that from happening. And that's really following that prescription and looking at how those long-term weather predictions, because it is the biggest factor, might play into the fire behavior of that prescribed fire. So we do have contingency resources, and that's something that we've learned from the past, is having those contingency resources in place. So if something were to get outside of those lines, we could catch it in a timely manner based on the fuels and topography that we have.
Now, as you mentioned, weather is obviously very important when it comes to wildfires. And we are now joined on the phone by Rich Naden, who's with the National Park Services. He's a fire meteorologist with what's called Predictive Services. Hello, Rich.
Hello.
Hi. So first of all, what is Predictive Services?
Well, we are a group of people that are spread across the country. There's about 20 meteorologists located at each geographic coordination center across the country, and we are pretty much involved with predicting the weather and the climate in regards to revolving around prescribed burning and wildfires. There's centers based in Atlanta. There's one in Redding, California. There's one in Minneapolis. So there's in various spots across the country where we're located.
Okay, so there are some obvious ways that wildfire could be impacted by the weather, lack or abundance of rainfall, perhaps. But are there other types of weather patterns that make a difference when it comes to fire risk?
I think that differs upon where you are in the country. Each specific area of the country has a varied, what we call, quite critical fire weather pattern that the meteorologists keep an eye out for. So that's something that's noteworthy. And, you know, like you mentioned a moment ago, certainly the weather and the climate ahead of the fire season impact what will become of each fire season.
What sort of patterns do you look out for in the Southwest?
Well, one pattern we look for that's critical down here is kind of the windy and dry pattern, which is associated with a trough of low pressure that moves eastward to our north. And coincidentally, we did not have too many of those this year at all. So that's kind of a strong wind, low humidity type pattern with hot temperatures out ahead of the cold front. So that's one of the critical patterns we have here in the Southwest area.
And how does that trough affect fires?
Well, I mean, again, it differs depending on where you are across the country. But you know, with a trough of low pressure, with a cold front, it's typically dry, windy, or dry, breezy, and hot out ahead of the cold front. So that allows the fuels to warm, become more available for burning. And if there's an ignition, they can obviously take off in the breezy and hot and dry conditions ahead of the cold front. Once the cold front is moving through, that would actually initially exacerbate the conditions in regards to a wind shift. And eventually, when the cooler, more moist and humid air arrives behind the cold front, that actually assists or helps any kind of wildfire ignition that would have occurred. So it's kind of a combination type thing, depending on where you are in that sequence.
So what kind of, how far into the future do your prediction models extend?
Good question. Well, we have models that actually go out in association with national centers across the country, you know, 6 to 9 months. Now that's pretty much a climate type model. The weather models go out 2.5 weeks or so, okay, as far as the fronts and specific low and high pressure systems.
And what kind of decisions does the Forest Service or the Park Service make based on these kind of longer term weather predictions?
Well, I guess you could say they're kind of looking at our products, Predictive Services products, in regards to what we're putting out on a monthly and seasonal basis for areas of what we call significant fire potential. So that's kind of what we focus on, is areas that we're thinking are going to be problematic, mainly because of dry conditions or increased lightning probabilities or a likelihood of seeing windy and dry conditions across the country. So we kind of put the dots together, look at climate, what's going on with the climate, and look what's going likely to occur with the upcoming weather patterns, and kind of put that together in what we call significant fire potential.
Okay. And what do we know about how something like climate change will impact fire risk in New Mexico and the Southwest?
Well, that's a little bit of a wild card. While a lot of the climate models are showing drying and increased warming temperatures in time, some of the models are also indicative or indicating that we could actually have some more humid conditions move in. And something we've seen here in the last 10 or 15 years is a more regular frequency of having more moist springs after even a dry winter. We have a wetter spring, and that has a strong impact on what occurs in our main wildfire season, which is typically April through July. So it's kind of a mixed bag in regards to what the long-term impacts would be in regards to climate change, I think.
Okay, well, I'm actually going to go ahead and thank you for joining us today, Rich. We're going to shift the conversation now to Smokey Bear, who I understand is actually celebrating a 75th birthday coming up. And I wonder if you guys could tell us a little bit about the history of Smokey Bear and how it ties into New Mexico.
Yeah, so the Lincoln National Forest and the Capitan Ranger District is, you know, as most of your listeners probably know, the origin of the living symbol Smokey Bear. But the U.S. Forest Service and the National and State Foresters, along with the Ag Council, have had came into an agreement of a fire prevention campaign on August 9th, 1944. So
and that actually predates the living bear.
Yeah, it does. But the Smokey Bear has been a constant and persistent message for preventing those human-caused ignitions since August 9, 1944. And it's the longest-running ag campaign in the United States history. So we're super proud to be a part of that and represent what we think is still a valid cause and champion that message to this day. Only you can prevent wildfires.
And I do want to point out it is Smokey Bear and not Smokey the Bear, correct?
True, yeah. Smokey Bear, came into play with a song that everyone knows. And it was just added to provide consistency with that song.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about how do human-caused fires, how do they typically start? What is the most common way?
Well, in the different parts of the country, it's different causes. There's a list of causes where human ignitions can be a cause, one of them being equipment, where vehicles are driving maybe on dry grass or maybe pulling a trailer where chains are sparking. But it seems more and more that we're hearing about the campfire issue. Specifically, the Santa Fe National Forest here recently has provided some pretty unique numbers about the 4th of July weekend and those impacts of campfires, almost 50 abandoned campfires on a weekend at one point. So that's something that, you know, that Smokey Bear campaign is really focused on, is trying to get folks to do the right thing, using that drown, stir, feel method to put out your campfire.
Right,
and
when we say abandoned campfires, we don't mean like a raging fire necessarily, right? Like sometimes it's just glowing coals that somebody did not pour water on and stir.
True, yeah. So it may not even be smoking. You may not even see smoke associated with those abandoned campfires, but we do have those fire prevention personnel, 18 of them in the state, that are cruising around and looking at the campsites and making sticking their hands in those fires to make sure that they're out cold. Okay. So not really escaped campfires. That would be where we'd call in the resources to help put out that wildfire, that uncontrolled wildfire. But if, forest visitors can just take the simple steps of bringing a bucket of water and a shovel and use a little drown stir feel to put out their fires, that would help out tremendously with those escaped ignitions.
Okay, so how much water do you need?
We like to promote 5 gallons.
5 gallons of water on a fire. Stir it up.
Yeah, stir it with your shovel and then feel it with the back of your hand, because we don't want to burn the palm of our hand, of course.
Carl?
So there's another point I want to come back to in terms of, you know, the idea of managing these landscapes for their ecological integrity. And this is something that I think is particularly important to bear in mind for folks here in the Southwest. And that's the relationship between wildfire and our water supplies. And, you know, one of the things that folks in New Mexico need to contemplate is the relationship between having abundant, clean, quality water at our tap and the condition of our forested landscapes up in the watershed. And there's a very critical direct linkage between the ecological health of our forests and the water. And we've got a number of great partnerships, certainly with New Mexico State Forestry, with the Nature Conservancy, New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, a whole host of non-governmental partners who are very interested in essentially sharing the stewardship of these forested landscapes. And here in New Mexico, a lot of that emphasis is going to be around that relationship between the forests and our water supplies. And everything that we were talking about earlier in terms of choosing the kind of fire you want to have, and whether or not it's a large-scale, high-severity fire or a relatively low-severity fire, there's a really critical linkage there to protecting our watersheds. And one example of that would be up in the Santa Fe Fire Shed, as we're calling it, on the Santa Fe National Forest, just east of the community of Santa Fe. There's been a lot of great partnership work done there specifically to protect the drinking water supply for the city of Santa Fe. And when Tessa was talking about those values at risk that we think about when it comes to wildfire, here in the Southwest, there's probably no more compelling value that we could be thinking about or talking about than the safety of our water supplies.
Now, I have an email comment from Phil. He says, with all due respect, all of this talk of fire management is moot unless we acknowledge and address the central issue of our time, human-caused climate change. If we continue to burn fossil fuels at our current rate, our southwestern forests will get drier and drier. It seems to me that this can only result in catastrophic fires becoming more and more common. The bottom line is, he says, change in the White House and getting back aboard the Paris Agreement. Do you guys have any comment on that? So how about the burning fossil fuels aspect of it?
Yeah, so I'm not going to comment on, you know, the Paris Agreement or the White House, but with all due respect, I could not agree more with what this listener is saying about the importance of us considering climate change. And actually, that fits well with regard to what we're trying to accomplish in terms of managing these forested ecosystems. So not only are we thinking in terms of trying to restore some of the historical fire regimes, but we're also thinking in terms of resilience to future disturbances that are likely to be exacerbated by human-induced climate change. So this listener's spot on. And when we think about the potential for these high-severity wildfires and everything that we heard about the way that climate fits into that from our colleagues at the Predictive Services, we can think in terms of managing these forests for future resilience. And that is front and center in our minds here at the U.S. Forest Service.
Do you have any advice for how the folks at home can contribute to or help with making sure that wildfire management continues to be a constructive thing going forward, or how they can, you know, make sure that they don't contribute to wildfires, human-caused wildfires themselves?
So you bring up a couple good points, and one is creating that defensible space around your home. In the event of a large wildfire, we know that homes burn sometimes. And, you know, if we take those proper precautions and steps to create that defensible space around our homes, that can really go a long way for the firefighters that are on the ground fighting the good fight.
So what is defensible space in this context?
So defensible space would be looking at that first 5 feet around your home, and then making sure that there's nothing that's going to be ignited or easily ignited within that first feet. Look at your decks, look at the siding, look specifically at those areas where pine needles and leaves and light flashy fuels were to accumulate in the corners of your home maybe, and that's the same place that an ember is going to go. So kind of be thinking about that, clean out your gutters, looking at the first 5 feet, and then looking at the next 30 feet, and maybe not having a continuous fuel bed or, you know, a bunch of brush or grass, tall grass coming up right next to that 5 foot buffer that you have around your house. And making sure the vegetation is spread out or it's green grass preferred. And then maybe even going even further out and looking at 100 feet. And what I like to tell folks is imagine a wall of flames coming at your house. And if you can minimize that fire behavior from 100 feet away from your house stands a way better chance of surviving. And it makes a firefighters more comfortable staying there to try to protect your house.
When it comes to human-caused wildfires, obviously campfires are a big issue. What other sources of human-caused wildfires should people be aware of and make sure that they don't accidentally contribute to?
Yeah, so you know, we have a bunch of campaigns that are directly related to public education and outreach, and one of them being One Less Spark, One Less Wildfire. That's an equipment-based campaign that you know, lets folks know not to be parking on dry grass or having a spark arrestor and a chainsaw or even your ATV when you're out recreating on national forest lands. And, you know, not dragging chains when you have your vehicle being pulled when you're coming to use your RV on national forest lands. Just make sure your chains are good and tight. We also have a campaign called Take Aim, which is focused on shooting-related fires and target practice on national forest lands. And so we really like to make sure that folks have a clear spot of vegetation when they do use those, when they do target shooting on national forests.
Okay, well, that is all the time that we have today. I want to thank you guys for coming in, and thanks to our phone guests for sharing your thoughts. The conversation does not have to end here. You can share your thoughts by commenting on KUNM.org or email letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Now, next Thursday morning at 8, Marisa DeMarco is hosting our second annual Let's Talk Free Stuff show about no-cost fun, fitness, and exercise opportunities around the state. I am Ty Bannerman. Elaine Baumgartle is our executive producer today, and she was dealing with the emails. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.